From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Kite by Carol Jacoby. Tuesday being Christmas, I slept late, worked until noon on my paper for the Batavia Medical Journal, and headed for the waterfront to arrange passage on the next KPM boat for Singapore. It was the anniversary of my 6 years' practice in Samarinda, and I was glad to be leaving Borneo for good. I returned to my quarters in the European district and began immediately the long job of packing. At 2 p.m., suddenly and without warning, a strange nervousness seized me. At the very moment the last strokes of the clock died into silence, a nameless fear swept through my brain, quickening my pulse. I lay no claim to being psychic. Indeed, as a man in my profession naturally would, I have always frowned upon anything suggesting the supernatural, but I have learned by past experience that such a feeling as I now experienced invariably presaged some black event, some tragedy within my own circle of acquaintanceship. A quarter of an hour later, I received the strange message from Cortland. The message was delivered by a Cantonese boy, and it read as follows. Dear Dr. Van Ruler, since Alice was to see you last, her illness, which you diagnosed as a touch of fever, has grown steadily worse. If you can possibly make the trip upriver before you leave Samarinda, I would be much indebted to you. I must warn you of one thing, however. If you do come, and you see a kite flying over the jungle near my place, on your life, make no attempt to pull it down. Faithfully, Edward Cortland. I read that letter twice before I looked up. I hadn't known Cortland long. A year ago he had wandered down from British North Borneo, where he had held the post of conservator of forests. Following him on a later steamer had come his lovely wife, Alice, and his daughter, Faye. There were ugly stories about Cortland. Rumor had it that the British government had requested his resignation after his cruelty to the Dyaks had caused a native outbreak in one of the forest preserves. Shortly after his arrival in Samarinda, the man took over an old rest house a short distance up the Mahakam River. There he had made his home, and there his wife and daughter were forced to accept the loneliness and the jungle with him. As the Cantonese boy stood there, I felt a strong desire to refuse the call. Frankly, I didn't like Cortland, but what I didn't understand was the mention of the kite. Kong Chao, I said, for I had spoken to Cortland's boy several times before, have the Dyaks in your district taken over the Malay practice of flying kites? The boy shook his head. The Malays are doing it then? No Malays there. Only one Dyak village. You come? I hesitated. Yes, I'll come, I said at length. Have your boatmen and sampan ready in half an hour. I'll meet you at the river jetty. My usual procedure during a trip upriver is to sit back in the shade of the thatch cabin, puff a pipe, and to wait until the chanting Dyaks pull the sampan to my destination. Today, however, I squatted tense in the bow under the hot sun and gazed at the steaming shores. For 2 hours, nothing happened. Then, as we approached the last turn before Cortland's place, Kang Chao pointed up into the sky, said, "See? Kite! Big kite!" The kite was there, and I could see it clearly from the river. There was nothing strange about it, an enormous cross-fashioned of two pieces of bamboo and red rice paper, the tail cut to resemble a dragon. But suddenly, I caught the sunlight at a new angle, and I gave a sharp exclamation. The line which held the kite was not native hemp, but wire. Copper wire. I could see it glinting like a slender strand of gold. The wire slanted down from the sky and disappeared in the jungle. "Inshore, Kang Chow," I snapped. "Inshore." Minutes before, I was fighting my way through the bush, fighting off a horde of insects. The wire ended abruptly at a large palapak tree. It was wound several times around the bowl and spliced. What was a kite doing here? Flying without human guidance. A native kite, and yet held down by white men's wire. Troubled, I headed back for the sampan. 10 minutes later, the boat slipped to a mooring beside the Corlin wharf, and I followed Kang Chow to the clearing and the house. Corlin met me at the door, shook hands, and ushered me into the central room. "Glad you could make it, Doctor," he said. "It's been hell waiting to see if you'd come. Alice is in the back room. My daughter Faye is attending her." "How is the patient?" I asked. "She's no better," Corlin replied. "I've kept her dosed with quinine, as you suggested. But it isn't fever that's troubling her. It's..." "In God's name, Doctor, did you see the kite?" I stared at the man. Corlin was hawk-faced with little pig eyes and a skin insect-bitten from years in the tropics, but something was troubling him. "Perhaps you'd better look her over first," he said. He led the way to a room in the rear. It was a small chamber with a single bed, the windows shutters partially closed, and a definite smothering odor of sickness. Corlin's wife lay motionless on the bed. In a chair by her side sat the daughter, Faye. I felt the woman's pulse, took her temperature. The heart action was rapid, but the thermometer showed below normal. Abruptly, Corlin stepped forward and drew me to the window. He pointed out into the sky. "Look," he whispered hoarsely. "Do you see it?" My gaze followed his hand, and again I saw that kite. It was still as high, but much closer, blown by the rising wind. The red rice paper glowed like a fever spot against the blue. "Yes, I see it," I said. "A kite. But what?" Corlin snapped at me before I could finish. "I want you to watch that kite, Van Ruler. Keep looking." Staring upward, I felt my own heart begin to hammer in my throat. "Now feel her pulse and keep watching that kite," Corlin directed. He lit a cigarette with shaking hands and leaned against the wall. For a long time, I kept my hand pressed to the limp wrist while I watched the kite, motionless, high over the jungle. Abruptly, the dragon tail sagged in a slackening of the wind, and the kite settled 50 feet downward. I whirled to the woman in the bed. Her breath was coming in short gasps. Her pulse was only a feeble flutter. But even as I ripped open my case and reached for a capsule of amyl nitrate, the sinking spell passed. The heart returned to normal. Outside, the kite was leaping, climbing like a frightened bird to new altitudes. But it was a quarter of an hour before I realized the hideous significance of it. With shaking fingers, I gave the woman a dose of strychnine. Stepping to the door, I motioned Corlin to follow. Back in the central room, I poured myself a glass of whiskey and faced the ex-conservator across the table. "Corlin," I said, trying to control my voice, "I've been in Borneo 6 years. I've treated everything from yellowjack to the bite of a hamadryad, but I never came upon anything like this before. It's good Lord, it is impossible." "I'm not crazy then," Corlin drummed his fingers. "You saw?" "I saw," I replied, "and impossible as it may sound, it's true. In some unholy way, your wife's physical condition is linked with the movements of that kite. When the kite is stationary or climbing, her pulse is normal. But the moment the thing begins to fall, her heart slows, and death is close." "How long has it been there?" "Since yesterday afternoon," Corlin replied. "I noticed it shortly after Alice became so weak she was forced to bed. The first thought that came to me was to pull the kite down. I tried it, and I almost killed her. Went over to that tree and began to pull it in slowly. Faye was to fire a revolver the moment she noticed any L effect. The shot came almost at once. He paced over to me. In heaven's name, what are we up against? I moved towards another doorway leading into a side chamber. Inside, I could see several cases, an array of curious objects on the wall. "Show me your collection," I said at length. "Perhaps it will give me time to think." Corlin's collection was well known through the district. Gathering it had been his one intense interest for many years. The man turned his head now, called, "Kang Chao, here, damn you, chop, chop!" The Cantonese boy came on the run, surmised Corlin's orders, quickly drew the shades in the other room. "Someone broke in here a couple of nights ago," Corlin said. "Tried to steal my things. Fired a shot at the sneak, but I missed." Most of Corlin's collections was Borneo stuff from the deep interior. There was also articles from Java, the Celebes, and China. I saw parangs, blowpipes, and pottery, but my eyes lingered on a case in a corner within which was an enormous piece of crimson silk. "That silk is pure Tibetan work," Corlin said, noting my interest. "Comes from the forbidden temple of Po Yong Kwan, the headquarters of the Nefet sect in North India. When I obtained it, it was adorning the supreme fire altar in what was known as the sacred flame room. I climbed up an outer wall, sneaked through an unbarred window, and lifted it when the priests were sleeping." "You stole it?" I exclaimed. Corlin nodded. "One has to do such things if he's going to have a collection. The silk has some mystic significance to a Tibetan. The priest called it the cloth of the fire god, and all the terrors of seven hells are supposed to follow anyone who defiles it. The beauty of the piece is the dragon design in the center. I don't know for sure, but I understand all sorts of evil, obscene rites have been practiced in its name. This is the least understood religion of Asia. It is steeped in black magic, and..." I stepped closer and examined the cloth. The lower right corner ended in a ragged edge where a section had been torn off. "The thief who broke in here did that," Corlin snarled. "I surprised him before he could rip it completely out of the case, and he got away in the darkness." "What is it, Faye?" The conservator's daughter had entered the room. Her face was white as lime. "Quick, doctor," she cried, "my mother." In 10 strides, I was into the room. But the moment I knelt at the woman's side, I realized she was beyond human aid. There was practically no pulse. An instant later, the death rattle sounded. Alice Corlin was dead. Still, holding the lifeless wrist, I looked through the window up into the sky. My eyes filled with horror. Even as I watched the kite slowly settle downward, it fell into the jungle and disappeared. Impatient as I was to leave Samarinda, the curious facts surrounding the death of Alice Corlin led me to postpone my departure. My certificate attributed her death to congestive malarial fever, but I knew only too well the cause went deeper than that. I had the kite. River Dykes near Corlin's house had brought it to me in return for a quantity of tobacco. It was made of bamboo sticks and rice paper, as I had suspected. But glued to the surface was a small remnant of red silk, a fragment from Corlin's fire god altar cloth. Exactly a week later, Corlin came to my quarters. He entered my veranda and faced me with haggard eyes. "Van Ruler," he said, "there's another kite." "What?" I cried. He nodded. "Exactly like the first. Same size, same color, same kind of wire. It's been up 2 days now, but it seems to disappear each night. And my daughter, Faye, it isn't affecting her, too?" A feeling of helpless horror swept over me. Corlin clenched his fist. "Not physically, the way it did Alice, but mentally. Something unspeakably evil is slowly claiming her soul." By this time, I was tense with excitement. Dislike Corlin, I did. But the events combined to draw me on with a hypnotic attraction. I told Corlin I'd go upriver in an hour. It had rained during the night, and as we paddled up the Mahakam, the sky was a leprous gray. Again, Kang Chao sat stiffly in the stern directing the dyke boatman. The kite came into view in almost identically the same spot. I had seen its predecessor. I watched it until the sampan thumped against the wharf, but I made no comment. A moment later in the house, I came upon Faye Corlin. She sat in a chair in the center of the room, rigid, eyes fixed ahead. There was a drawn look of terror in her face. Her lips were white. For 5 minutes, I spoke to her soothingly. She did not respond. Instead, abruptly and without warning, she leaped to her feet, gave a choking cry. Then, like a lifeless thing, she slumped to the floor. Even as I bent over her, I knew my worst fears were realized. The kite was working again. But this time I had no intention of standing by without intervention. The girl's physical condition was linked with the movement of that kite. Impossible as it seemed, I knew that was true. The kite could not be pulled down, or Faye Corlin would die. It must be destroyed in midair. I seized my medicine case and ran out. I dashed along the jungle path and down to the jetty. I leaped into the sampan and paddled furiously for the opposite shore. Overhead, low-bellied storm clouds were racing in from the horizon. The sky to the east was a sickly green. Following the copper wire, I reached the far bank and plunged into the bush. The fire was fastened to the same palapak tree. I opened my case and fell to work. From one compartment, I drew forth a quantity of pyraloxin, spread it before me. 40 grams of pyraloxin mixed with either ether or alcohol makes collodion, which is useful in treating small wounds. Pyroxylin is nothing more than gun cotton. I had in my case also a brass tube, capped at both ends to carry matches. Tearing off the caps, I inserted the gun cotton. Next, from an inner pocket, I drew forth a large piece of paper, then ripped free my watch chain. You've seen a boy send a message up a kite string, driven upward by the wind. I was doing much the same thing, only my message was a charge of inflammable gun cotton. The slightest charge of lightning from the oncoming storm would be sufficient to ignite the pyroloxin and destroy the kite in midair. I refastened the wire to the tree again, then threaded the paper up the wire. As I worked, the storm raced nearer. The kite rode high above the undulating roof of the jungle. I released it. For a moment, the message hung motionless. Then, with a low hum, it began to mount upward along the wire. I rushed back to the sampan and paddled back across the river. Back in the house, I found Faye unconscious on the cot in the collection room where Corlin had carried her. At the far side of the room, peering out the window, stood the Cantonese boy, Kang Chao. I waited. One hand clamped to the girl's wrist, I knelt there. Corlin paced back and forth across the room. If he saw Kang Chao, he gave no sign. The room was half-masked in shadows. In the corner, the crimson silk, the fire god cloth from the Tibet temple, shone luridly in its bamboo case. Its scarlet surface seemed enlarged 100 times. The storm drew nearer. From out of the east, a blacker cloud raced over the jungle, and then, knifing down, a jagged fork of lightning shot toward the kite. A roar of thunder trembled the very piles of the house. 5 seconds later, a sheet of flame burst out into the sky, high above the open window. The fire swept down the dragon tail like a devouring monster, and the wire dropped earthward like a writhing snake. The kite was gone. Instantly, a violent tremor shot through the stricken girl. A gasp came to her lips. The pulse became a pounding hammer. Then the beat slowed to normal, and I leaned back with a cry of exultation. But at that instant, any thought of success was thrust from my mind. A muffled cry from Kang Chao spun me around. The Cantonese boy stood rigid, eyes fastened on the crimson silk in the case beside him. And it was that silk that held my own gaze. Even as I watched, a streamer of smoke appeared over the design of the fire god. A tongue of flame shot outward. Corlin whirled. One instant he stood motionless, then the door of the case shot open, and slowly, a fraction of an inch at a time, the flaming silk began to move outward. Of its own accord, without support, it moved, lifted into the air, began to float across the room. Relentlessly it closed in on Corlin. The conservator's face was ashen. He tried to turn, but seemed riveted to the spot. Horrified, I watched the flaming silk lessen the intervening distance. Then with a final jerk, it leaped forward. The burning mass dropped over Corlin's head, tightened like a shroud. I swear I was powerless to move. For an instant, I vow some outer power prevented me from taking a single step. Screaming hideously, Corlin fell to the floor. A curtain of smoke rolled over him. Into my nostrils swept the odor of burning flesh. I broke the spell then and ran forward. I snatched at the cloth with both hands. It resisted all efforts. I seized a rattan rug, attempted to smother the flames, but the fire only flared higher. At last, Corlin's hands flailed wildly in a last death agony. He sank downward and lay still. Fake Corlin left Samarinda on the 29th of January. My own passage to Singapore and thence to home was scheduled for a week later, but Kang Chao disappeared. I might have explained the Cantonese boy part in the death of Edward Corlin to the Dutch authorities, or I might have asked for an inquest and testified to all that I knew. Yet somehow those facts, if brought to light in a colonial court of law, would have seemed even more impossible. I can offset the whole thing by cataloguing a few of my subsequent findings. There was, for example, the can of petrol which I discovered under Corlin's house. There was the spool of wire, a section of which had been stretched across the collection room, presumably as a supporting line for a bamboo curtain. Such a wire might conceivably have served as a track for the floating, flaming silk. And there was my own knowledge that the Chinese will sacrifice anything to attain the proper theatrical effect. For Kang Chao, as was later revealed, was not a Cantonese coolie. He was a Tibetan, a former priest of the forbidden temple of Po Yong Kwan, from which the cloth of the fire god had been stolen. And yet there was the kite, the death of Corlin's wife, and the strange effect on the life of the daughter Fei. Perhaps it was fever that caused these things, but I do not think so.